Welcome to a psychodelicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from two local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, DNP, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond. Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
Hey, I'm Michael Stratton.
And I'm Morgan Bowen.
And we are here today to try to fake our way through an hour in two parts of talking about codependency.
Codependency, that is the topic.
That is the topic. And the reason I say that is that, you know, quite often with the topics we talk about, I consider myself, you know, like, hey, I'm an expert on trauma. I'm an expert on, you know, fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. Codependency mm-hmm. is like, I don't know if I know enough about it.
I know, it's true.
But as I read more about it, I realized like, oh, it's not that I don't know more about it. I am it. And Dedalion is with us producing. We're going to rely on you, Dedalion, to tell your life story.
Oh, that'd be great. I'm sure I've got something going on there.
Do you feel like people know the word codependency?
I actually would say the best way to start this conversation is with a definition.
Well,
because that's exactly where I'm going. I'm like, I don't know.
Do you have a good one?
Well, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I always read is that it's very hard to define. It's easier to see, I think, than it is to define. But do you have like a textbook definition?
It's like pornography, you know. I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Isn't that what somebody said once?
It's true. I don't know who said that, but I feel like that's...
Yeah. I do not want to look that up on the system here in the college. I'm not looking that quote up.
Well, I'll tell you what I think is. So, you know, codependency is when there's a partnership. So co means that there's got to be two people involved. But when one person's focus is really on what the other person is doing, and frequently what the other person is doing incorrectly or wrong. And so the person's life is kind of lived in orbit of the other person. So the focus is always on the other person. Frequently, you know, I think about it in terms of like when there's an addiction in a family. And so the attention is focused on the alcoholic or, you know, the person with the substance use disorder and trying to get them to change and get them to stop. And why are they doing this? And, you know, your mind is always focused on that person, or over time it develops that person is just 100% focused on what's happening with the other person, to the point that they really are not living their own life.
Hmm. So I agree with that. And the other kind of fascinating piece of that is that it always does, you know, occur in a relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't exist just on its own. Yeah. But the feature is someone who's adapting to someone else's style. And if it's an underfunctioning style, it happens that way. But if it's a rigid style, it can happen that way as well. So I think the key thing is being in relationship with someone who has a rigid style of being, whether that's I'm rigid because I'm addicted and that's not going to change, or it's rigid because I'm narcissistic and I only care about myself and you have to adapt to me. It can happen that way. Someone who has a character style that's particularly rigid, unbendable, unbreakable, you know, psychopath, sociopath, different things of that sort. So it can happen in a number of ways. And also the idea, you know, we throw the term around like it's a bad thing. And I think in some ways, someone who is trying to kind of bend over backward to help other people, if we were all codependent, it would be a better world. To some extent, you know, because it is people that are trying to adapt to someone else. And let me help you with that. But doing it to the point that it's at their own expense.
Caretaking is a central concept or quality, I think, you know, for sure, in a codependent individual or a codependent relationship. Somebody feels compelled that they need to take care of the other person and that they cannot, you know, that person can't live without them. And so it sets up a dynamic where that person needs you, but, you know, in a relationship in which somebody's always trying to fix things, that can lead to conflict and tension because not, you know, people usually don't want everything fixed.
To be fixed.
Yeah, at all times. And so that can lead to resentment, you know, on both parts. And so, you know, a foundation of something that could have been very well-meaning can turn into something very toxic over time.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting too, guys. I was just thinking that codependency, I was talking about rigidity, but sometimes people are rigidly codependent that they can't seem to stop themselves from helping other people. And people in the helping profession, I think, are prone to that. I've been called out by my therapist. By the way, I believe my therapist is starting to listen to our podcast.
Well, that's good.
Maybe. She said she was going to. I should highlight this one in particular.
Yeah, yeah.
I've offered. I said, you can be a guest on it at some point. She doesn't want to do that. No, no, no.
Rewinding back to where you were talking about the rigidity, and then you said another word, unfunctioning? Is that what it was?
Underfunctioning.
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 What did you mean by that?
So someone who... sometimes it's tied to an addiction. Sometimes it's tied to really low self-esteem or to some kind of deficit. Deficit, I don't even like that word, but something that is going on for the person that they're not kind of living up to their potential, you know. That's what teachers.
Or another thing I would think of is, maybe it's a dynamic in a family where one of the individuals is professional outside of the home, you know, very focused on work. They're at work all the time, and the other partner is, you know, taking care of everything else, making sure that, you know, everything's really clean and the meals are made and the kids are taken care of and the house is perfect. And you know, there's a desire to do that independently of that person's, you know, that other person's role. But then it becomes like it upsets the person if things aren't perfect. Mm. And so it can create that dynamic that, you know, I have to do this or else. And then their choices, their life, their schedules are pivoting around what the other person is doing. And they don't feel like they have their own life or their own ability to do things that are of interest to them. They can't grow in a way that they may like to because they are busy or focused on facilitating the other person.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying. I think the distinction between someone who's a natural helper and then someone who falls into codependency can be connected to what that person's internal experience is. So if you are helping someone a lot, but you find yourself starting to either regret it or resent it, that's a sign. Like, I'm giving too much. Mm-hmm. I'm giving so much that this is starting to bother me. And yet I can't seem to stop it. I can't seem to draw that boundary for myself. That so it has that quality of being kind of overdetermined or kind of driven in a way mm-hmm. of the person, which is what my therapist has accused me of.
Well, I always say, you know, any
just
long
throwing it on the table just in case she's just, listening.
Just in
I'm
case.
Sorry. I think any long-term relationship, marriage, committed relationship, there's an element of codependence to it because, you know, you are a partnership and you've made a life together and you're doing things, you know, that involve both of you. So I think necessarily that includes a level of codependence, but it can definitely, you know, the problems happen when the resentment starts. And if it's a situation where the one person's feeling that they're contributing to the other person's life at the expense of being able to do their own.
Well, resentment comes along probably when it feels like you're being controlled is what I would think.
Yes. Well, you know, control
may sound like I'm speaking from experience, but I know nothing about this at all.
Well, so in a codependent relationship, the resentment can go, it goes both ways. So the person who's the helper, you know, and I guess to these roles are very rarely so easily defined. And, you know, there's kind of fragments of these experiences in both parties. But, you know, the helper, the one who wants to help, is resentful that even though they're giving so much, the other person isn't doing what they want them to,
right,
or isn't performing in a way that they want them to, or making more money, or, you know, stopping drinking, or, you know, whatever it may be. And then the person that is being helped, quote unquote, is resentful at the other person for trying to fix them. Like, mm-hmm. quit trying to fix me. I'm doing mm-hmm. my own, you know, that kind of thing. So it goes both ways. And that's the dynamic that can lead to extreme toxicity. Silent meals, dagger stares, you know, very tense, minimal conversation.
Right. You know, the
these are kind of things I picture across the dinner table in, like, I don't know, the 60s or the 70s.
Yeah, the idea of
mom and dad.
If I do this for you, you will return and do this other thing. But the deal is never clearly articulated, you know, so the idea is never really clearly like, If I'm particularly nice to you, or I ignore your drinking long enough, sooner or later you're going to stop drinking, and mm-hmm, it doesn't mm-hmm, happen, mm-hmm. And then the resentment builds. So I mean, when it's attached to, particularly if it's attached to something that would be called pathological in some way, that's when that whole cycle starts to really escalate. So. I've got a list of some traits.
Well, let me read this. I want to.
Oh, this is, you got the melody.
So, he's actually got a book.
I've got this on a book.
So Melody Beattie is writes. She's been around since the, you know, 70s and writes a lot of books related to codependence, including kind of the Bible, Codependent No More. Yeah. And so she comes from more of a 12-step addiction background. She herself, which she describes in her books, is an alcoholic, and then recognized that she also had codependent qualities and, you know, kind of focused part of her career on that. So in her book, Codependent No More, she says, most codependents were obsessed with other people. With great precision and detail, they could recite long lists of the addict's deeds and misdeeds, what he or she thought, felt, did, and said, and what he or she didn't think, feel, do, and say. The codependents knew what the alcoholic or addict should and shouldn't do, and they wondered extensively why he or she didn't do that, did or didn't do it. Yet these codependents who had much great insight into others couldn't see themselves. They didn't know what they were feeling. They weren't sure that what they thought, and they didn't know what, if anything, they could do to solve their problems, if indeed they had any problems other than the alcoholic.
Summarize that.
Well, so, you know, this comes from, you know, more of a substance use disorder tradition, with the kind of image of the partner, the long-suffering partner who really wants to help this person get sober. And so all of their energy and mind and attention is spent trying to help that person get sober, or figure out how, you know, what is the secret. And if you do this over year after year after year, you try everything, and nothing works. And so the discontent, the resentment bubbles and burns and boils over, and you lose all sense of yourself. Mm. And what is it that I'm feeling outside of this resentment and rage that's taken over my life? I don't know what I feel other than that. I don't know who I am. I don't know mm-hmm. what I want. I don't, you know, everything. My whole life, I wake up thinking about this person. I go to bed thinking about this person and trying to figure out how to help them. And, you know, that turns into something toxic.
Mm. That's one of the big traits, is that... that focus on the other to the neglect of your own self. And I had not put this together myself, which seems crazy, but I had not until I was reading about this some more, that one of the things that'll happen sometimes when I'm in a session with somebody, and they'll talk about, you know, they'll talk about whatever the complaint is, and I'll just simply reflect back what they said. And they'll act like they're hearing it for the first time because it's like they don't even know. They say, wow, it's amazing how you could put that together. And I just said, well, that's what you just told me. And they don't listen to their own internal dialogue even. It's like it's news to them what they think or what they feel.
It's true. There can be such a lack of insight. They come into therapy or, you know, to see me, and, you know, you're a therapist. I'm sure you can concur, provide your own examples. But they spend 40 minutes talking about, you know, their spouse or, you know, their kid or, you know, whoever it may be. And they spend zero time talking about themselves or, you know, anything really about themselves. And anytime you try to kind of pivot the conversation to, mm-hmm. you know, what is your internal, you know, feeling about that, it always ends up back on the other person. So that's a time when I'm working with somebody where I'm thinking, you know, there's something going on in the relationships or some level of dysfunction, you know, that can be definitely described as codependence.
Yeah. So some of the characteristics, if I can read my phone now.
You should have brought a book.
I should have brought a book. I should have run this off so it looked more official. But anyway, the tendency to minimize or ignore your own needs. What I want is less important than who I have to serve. You know, of what's going on with this other person who has greater needs than I do, or I need to sacrifice what it is, and whether that's time, whether that's finances, whether that's attention, whatever that is. The next one is neglecting your own needs and desires to satisfy those in the other person. And the next one is self-worth or self-esteem that depends on what others think of you. So there's that whole people-pleasing thing. Mm-hmm. And to a good extent, I'm guilty of that. Mm-hmm. I would say that people-pleasing kind of thing. I want people to like me. And the payoff is that the person that you're connected to is going to like you, that if you give them enough, they're going to reward you for that in some way.
The people pleasing, and I think constructing your identity in opposition or in relation to another person. I am this person because I do something for this other person, you know, as opposed to having an independent, standalone self-worth or self-image.
This is kind of a stereotype, but when a couple is talking about where do you want to go to eat, and one person says, I don't know, I don't care what it is, you know, I don't know. So they don't know what it is. Well, let's have pizza. Well, we had pizza last night. Okay, would you like to go get Mexican? No, I'm not. You know, I'm just like negating one thing after another, but also not being able to articulate what it is that they would like to eat that they don't, and they might not know. They might not know. They may only know what they don't like, but not what they would like. Mm. So that would be kind of a quality. It's lightly codependent, you know. But I remember one time I walked into this was a fast food place, and this couple had walked in behind me. This was many, many years ago. And the guy asked his girlfriend, I'm hoping it was his girlfriend. I hope they weren't married. But he said, what do you want? And she said, I don't want anything. He said, well, then let's go. She said, no, you're hungry. And he said, no, let's go. If you're not going to eat it, let's go. And she said, I'm not hungry. You're hungry. You said you're hungry. Get something to eat. Well, what do you want? I don't want anything. And it was just, I mean, they were locked into this dysfunctional pattern that was like, oh, God, I hope you guys aren't. I hope this is your first date. You know?
So wow.
It went on and on.
As you say that, I think of some of the conversations I've had, and I might have had that conversation somewhere.
Was it you?
It probably was.
Well, why do we talk about codependence? I mean, what are the, you know, again, I think codependence is a part of everybody's relationship, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a horrible thing.
Do you think it grew out of the recovery community? Do you think that's where it started?
As far as my, like, exposure to it and my own, you know, path with it, and is through the recovery community. So, and reading Melody Beattie as my, you know, kind of primary, you know, source of thinking about codependence, because, you know, she comes out of the recovery community. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how that's the perspective that I come from. But no, I don't think it has to be. You know, I think that there's codependence in, you know, the potential for codependence is in any relationship, any co-partnership.
And again, I would underline that I think there has to be an element of rigidity, you know, for it to really grow up. When you grow up in a system that's rigid, where there's a level of dysfunction,
that's important.
Yeah, then you're more likely to develop that as a
well.
As
there was a
whole
child
strategy.
Of you know adult child of alcoholics that was you know big on the scene. You know, in the 80s, would you say 80s, 90s?
There seems 70s, to be a time 80s. That, yeah. Yep.
So I think codependency kind of came around that time, around the you know, AA as a 12-step organization has been around since like the 30s, but in the 60s and the 70s, you know, there was NA, and then Al-Anon kind of developed, you know, a little bit before that. But, you know, it seems like in that 60s, 70s into the 80s was when that family dynamic, interpersonal dynamics, and the effect that addiction or alcoholism has on that.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you look at the literature in AA, for instance, and they do address relationships, they do address families, they recognize that this, you know, alcoholism has an impact on the whole family. That got developed further, and people would actually, I think one of the treatment centers here used to put on a play where they would show like the different roles that people play in alcoholic families. Like I'm the scapegoat, and someone else is like, I'm the clown. I'm the funny one. I'm the overachiever. I'm going to be the one who makes everyone proud. I'm going to create more chaos than you can, you know, so I'm going to distract in this way, you know, so they all had these different roles that you tended to see again and again and again in alcoholic families. And then they did tend to play out, you know, quite often, but all of those roles could be in some way or another defined as kind of a codependent stance. I'm doing this in relationship to something that is really out of control.
So. Yeah, and so I think one of the big things is that, you know, relationship dynamics start from the primary relationships that you have in your family. So in the place that you, you know, the dynamic in which you grew up in. And so codependence and patterns of relationship are learned early, very early, and they can be very hard to break as you move forward. And sometimes people don't, you know, they don't recognize the damage that their own tendency to recreate these relationships is causing them. Mm-hmm. And so they feel, you know, that it's always the other person's fault. I mean, you know, if the relationship pattern exists continually with, you know, destructive or chaotic people, then certainly the other person's behavior is going to play a huge part. But the initial foundational pattern of recreating this type of relationship pattern, getting involved in relationships that, you know, there's plenty of red flags, or, you know, probably from an objective point of view, it's probably not a great idea. You know, people come to treatment when they can't take it anymore, when they're either the relationship that they're in is so toxic that they just hate themselves. They hate themselves. They hate the other person. Their life is joyless. Like they just don't have anything.
Yeah. It feels like a big compromise.
Yeah. Right? Or their relationships are continually so destructive. They want love. They want a family. They want stability, but they continually get into these relationships that don't, that just are never going to be that. They're just never going to allow for that. Mm-hmm. I think codependence has something to do with both of those. Would you agree, Mike?
I would agree with that. I would think that also I think that the payoff, the idea that there's a payoff eventually, that if I act in this certain kind of way, I'll finally get what I want. But it's not anything to ever be stated directly. And a part of that is because it's unconscious. What you really do want is kind of unconscious. You know, I want the other person to change in some way, but I'm hardly even able to articulate that. So that being a piece of it, the ability to get in touch with what it is that you need, what it is that you want, and the ability to start to express that. And that brings us to conflict, because that's another area in codependent relationships where conflict is quite often not expressed, or it's expressed in a real kind of passive aggressive way. So it's so funny how it bleeds over into different areas, because really when you talk about codependency, you're talking about attachment styles, you're talking about
your inner family
systems. Stuff all kinds of things that it touches into, and yet it is kind of a vague thing. But the ability to help other people. So this week, you know, for instance, I'm not gonna get specific about it, but I helped somebody. They called me. He said, I need some help. I was able to go out and help him. It was winter. I was able to help him and do that. And I felt good about it. I didn't feel put out by it. I felt like I'm being a good guy, you know. And now I'm telling people about it so I can get your approval. thought of like it would be cool if people are more like that in a way. But if I had done it and I resented it and said, you know, this person's always asking for this and why can't I ever, it's never reciprocal, it's always this, you know, then it slips into codependency. I think that's the difference, you know, the main difference that I see. So it's good to help people, but if it goes over the line and you find you're churning internally because of it, you might be having some codependency going on.
So obviously there's no treatment for this. So on the second part of this,
we're just going to continue to riff.
There's treatment.
We'll talk about that. There's treatment.
There is hope.
A Psychodelicious Conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google therapy or therapists in your area, check with community mental health or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike and Morgan welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send us an email at apsychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com. That is a psychodelicious, psychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton and Morgan Bowen, and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited. Featuring the faculty, staff, students, and others that helped to make Lansing's premier college what it is today. LCC Connect, Mid-Michigan's connection to Lansing Community College. To find out more about our featured programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
K-12 Operations at Lansing Community College is a proud collaborator of the Mason Promise Scholarship. The Mason Promise Scholarship is a community organization of volunteers that guarantees funding for 2 years of Lansing Community College education to selected Mason Public School students. For more information on the Mason Promise Scholarship at LCC, please visit lcc.edu/hope.
Hi, I'm Diana. As a veteran, I know that for many servicemen and women, the battle doesn't always end when they come home, because I too struggle with the invisible wounds of service. Thankfully, I found American Humane's Pups for Patriots program, which brought Sam into my life. Before being paired with Sam, I didn't get out of bed for most days. Pups for Patriots and Sam literally changed my life. Now I'm able to go to the store without having a panic attack. I'm finally able to live my life the way I want to live it. Pups for Patriots provides trained service dogs to veterans like me at no cost. If you're a veteran or know a veteran struggling with post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury, please go to AmericanHumane.org to learn about their Pups for Patriots service dog program. Let's give our veterans a fighting chance.
A message from American Humane.
The Job Training Center at Lansing Community College provides 2-month job training opportunities that are free to eligible participants. Training courses range from information technology to administrative assisting. For more information, visit lcc.edu/JTC training.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Coach Cuts Corner. Streaming bright from Michigan's capital city, this podcast is dedicated to helping you better understand the who, the what, and the why of mental performance, personal growth, and Lansing Stars baseball. Coach Cuts Corner, brought to you by IWASH.
In collaboration with Lansing Community College.
And now here's your host, Stephen Cutter.
Welcome to Coach Cut's Corner. Thank you for tuning in and subscribing. Each week, I aim to provide insights into our program and inspire you to challenge yourself just as I continue to challenge myself. My goal is to help you enhance your life through these conversations. In addition to this podcast, I offer mental skills coaching for athletes at all levels, from the youth to professional. To learn more, visit CoachCutter.com. Today in the WLNZ studios, I have assistant coach Jeff Allen, and we're going to be previewing the topic of resiliency in the sports world. Jeff's role on our team is your assistant coach here. You mainly work with our infielders. You help with our offense. You help with our day-to-day operations. You have a lot of titles here. You know, yeah. Maybe only one on on the website with assistant coach, but as you know, in the baseball world and probably in all of the coaches' worlds, you've got to wear a lot of hats.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you got to learn to love wearing those hats, too. That's one thing that I've really started to enjoy throughout my coaching journey is at first when I would get invited to coach something that I wasn't too familiar with, I would just get super nervous. And then, you kind of just face it head on and learn as much as you can about it and pick the people's brains that have done it and done it successfully and kind of incorporate that into what you're working with.
Success leaves clues, and it's very important to pay attention to the people or programs or things that have had success. I want to start with a Stoic thought on resiliency. I love the Stoicism, and it's by Marcus Aurelius, and it's the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. Obstacles and challenges aren't setbacks, but opportunities to grow stronger and more resilient. And I think like when we run into obstacles or setbacks, oftentimes it's just frustration that takes over. And then you start stepping back. You take steps backwards.
Right.
And you've experienced obstacles and setbacks. I've experienced obstacles and setbacks. And the players that we coach all experience the same stuff. Yeah. So it's really just understanding that persistence and resilience only come from having been given the chance to work through difficult problems. And that's where resiliency comes from, by not necessarily stepping back, but stepping forward through it, you build that muscle of resiliency.
Right.
Mental toughness could be another word for it. I think athletes and coaches and individuals build resilience by embracing adversity and turning challenges into learning experiences. I think there's some common misconceptions about resiliency that I've heard. And a few of them that I think about is it's not just toughness. Resiliency isn't about ignoring emotions or toughing it out. It's about processing challenges, learning, and adapting. It's not innate. Resiliency isn't something you're born with. It's a skill you can develop through intentional effort and practice. It's the muscle.
Yeah.
It's not an absence of struggle. Resilient people, they still struggle. They might struggle more than the average person, but they just persevere and grow through it. So I wanted to talk about kind of understanding resiliency like through your lens, and kind of in your words, what does resiliency mean to you? And especially in the context of sports.
Well, you touched on a lot of the points that resiliency means to me, but I think that the most important thing with resiliency to me is really being able to keep that long-term goal in focus if you're facing adversity.
That's great.
So it's just not necessarily focusing on what that problem is. It's just trying to take what you can learn from that problem and just keep pushing through it. And like I said, just keeping that main goal in focus.
Yeah, it's being able to see the trees amongst the forest, and it's being able to understand, you know, what's my why?
Yeah.
You know, that pushes you through things. When you don't know what your why is or why you want to do something, and I think we'll talk about that as we get further into this podcast, you're going to struggle.
Absolutely.
But when you know what your why is, you can definitely push through. How about in your playing career, where resiliency was maybe a defining factor for you, whether it might be for success or maybe on the other side of the coin?
Yeah, I think that you can find a lot of points of resiliency no matter what stage you're in, whether that's coaching or playing. I think the one that sticks out the most to me would probably be the first school that I went to. I wasn't too sure where I was going to end up going to college. Finally found a school in Kansas, get down there, and I'm working hard, you know, and shoulder blows out. So it's like, oh, man, am I going to let that just define my career? Am I going to keep that main goal in focus and, you know, prove people wrong?
You had a bigger why, I'm assuming, when you got hurt.
Yep. I mean, just to be able to kind of show my family and my younger siblings that, like, no matter what you're going through, as long as you just keep pushing through it and just stay focused, I think that you can accomplish anything you put your mind to.
Yeah. Usually those whys are pretty intrinsic. Usually they're not super extrinsic like fame or fortune. They're pretty intrinsic, and usually they do gravitate back to family.
Yeah. That's always been a big reason why for me, and I think that's definitely the biggest piece of resiliency for me, is being able to get through that shoulder surgery and then come back and continue playing, and now into the coaching career where it's really blossomed into something I really didn't see at the time. I just knew that I wanted to be involved with baseball in any way that I could, because it's, you know, it can change lives.
Have you seen our approach to building resiliency in our program with our players, maybe both on and off the field? You could speak about like our offense and how we build resiliency there. I mean, what have you seen? Because you're fairly new here. You've been here with us for about a half a season at this point. We're getting ready to start our 2025 season. But what have you seen as we build in our program?
As far as off the field goes with building resiliency, I think that our leadership classes and our mental performance every day really plays a huge role in that. I think that the ability to keep pushing through your problems comes from the preparation that you put into it. So being able to go and consistently work on mental performance every day and go to our leadership class every week, that's the foundation of your belief system, is those steps. So I think that that is a huge part of it off the field. I think on the field, as far as resiliency goes, especially with hitters, we do a lot of constraint-based training, which when guys come in, at least the freshmen, I've seen, they'll be a little frustrated when they're going through, and you got your skinny bats and your smash factor balls and you know, you're really questioning things, but being able to push through that and realize that it's going to be harder in practice so that it's easier in games, I think that really helps with their resiliency on the field. And just the overall, it's kind of a buzzword, but the culture in our dugout when, like, a guy gets out, you know, or you know, they're not having a great day in the field, when guys come and pick them up, that also helps with that resiliency, because it would be nice to be able to be resilient by yourself all the time, but having a strong support system around you really helps with that resilience, I think.
I love that. I think that as coaches, we face challenges that require us to stay composed and bounce back quickly. And that's kind of where the modeling comes into play. And we're constantly facing challenges, and can we stay composed, and can we come up with a game plan to bounce back? Just like at the football level, you get a halftime to make adjustments for what just happened in the first half. Maybe you want to keep stacking bricks with what you're doing, and maybe you want to just change the whole foundation of what that first half was and start over with a really small micro brick, and we're going to come out of the locker room and we are going to do this because we couldn't do this one time, you know. And so that's kind of what it looks like. But then there's also the other piece where you're trying to balance being tough on players with showing them grace and understanding. And that's one of the things of that where I'll use like the words like seek perspective.
Yeah.
You know, somebody shows up late for something and you automatically want to say, this is where our standards are. But you also have to have a little bit of compassion.
Yeah.
And know they're young, probably living on their own for the first time, probably trying to figure out, you know, X and Y for the very first time without a whole lot of help outside of our program. And it just happened. And it's not so much about that it just happened. It's about showing a little bit of empathy, a little bit of compassion, and saying and thinking if they can grow from this.
Right.
If yeah. they're showing up late every day, then we have a large problem. But if they mess up and they can grow from it, then I believe that's called impact, and I love impact. And we see players in our program that come in, they might be a little bit selfish, they're into themselves and not necessarily always thinking about others, and they mess up sometimes, and it's like we have high standards here, we hold them accountable, but there's also some empathy for them.
Yeah.
And we allow them to grow, and that's I think a big reason why we see a lot of the growth that we do, because I mean, you even hit on it in our offensive side of the practice. It's challenging. There's a lot of failure. That's yeah. not a buzzword. That's we're not overblowing something. It's the real deal. There's a lot of failure. And if you get a round of seven, there are stations where you will be super fortunate to get, you know, three barrels off a round of seven.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's challenging. And instead of saying, poor me, I suck, I you know, those right. things that you initially hear in the start of the process, pretty soon you start looking around and you see people shaking their heads saying, mm-hmm, this is what it looks like.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking when I see that, mm-hmm, this is what it looks like, I'm thinking, yep. That's where the resiliency muscle is starting to grow. And in our sport, and I believe in all sports, but baseball is extremely, extremely challenging
yeah.
sport.
Have to be resilient.
And there's a lot of challenges that are thrown at you, not only in the box, but on the pitching rubber, in the field, on the scoreboard. With the weather, with the umpires, you know, just with fans, with travel, with food, with right. with everything. So you're getting all these things, and somehow you've got to somewhat try to build in programs calluses,
yeah,
so that you can become stronger. And those things can become more than just a buzzword of we focus on what we can influence, and they become something that you are.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a really special thing, and I think adversity is inevitable on the path to greatness. Resilience is about adapting and thriving when faced with challenges. There's a Stoic philosophy that says you have power over your mind, not outside events. Sounds like a baseball game to me.
Exactly.
Realize this and you will find strength. And I think in my coaching career, I've experienced a ton of adversity, not only for myself and family, but I've also experienced it just as the coach, watching players go through things that are much bigger than striking out or throwing a ball to the backstop.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where some of the adversity and empathy come together for understanding. We try to teach in our program, I think, what a lot of people try to teach, and we just do it with insane consistency. But to control what you can, focus on effort, attitude, and how you prepare. Those are all things that you have total bear hug around that you can do. And we try to reframe failure. Failure isn't ever the end. It's more or less feedback. And it's sometimes awful tasting medicine. but you need it. And we try to encourage athletes to ask, what did I learn from that?
Yeah.
What did I learn? And I don't think you need to lose games to learn. But I think when you do experience setbacks, if you can ask yourself, what did I learn? You have a chance to continue stacking bricks and moving forward. And then probably the last thing is really just understanding that it's micro wins. It's celebrating small victories helps build that muscle of resilience. And this is really tied into our brick stacking philosophy. And you can win. You can have incredible days when the scoreboard says that you shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And you can have amazing moments when the box score says that you didn't have a great game.
Right.
It's about plus ones. It's about stacking. I believe there are four layers of resiliency, and I wouldn't mind if you added something to these four layers if anything pops in your mind. But as I was preparing for this podcast, I thought, you know what? There's mental resilience, the ability to stay composed under pressure and bounce back from mental challenges. There's emotional resilience. How you handle the emotional toll of setbacks and failures while trying to stay positive and trying to stay focused. What's your why? There's physical resilience, the importance of caring for your body to endure the physical demands of sports and life. And you think about the physical resilience that we have in our program, because it's going to be challenging and you need to be able to take care of your body to the best of your ability. You might not have all the people that some other programs have, but you can focus on what you can control. And the final layer is social resilience. And it's building and leaning on a support network, which can be us as coaches, it can be your teammates, it can be your family, and it can be your friends. How do you think like our team culture promotes resiliency amongst our players and staff?
I think that kind of like I talked about earlier is just like the ability of our guys to be able to pick somebody up when they can tell that they're not feeling the greatest at the moment. And I think that going through and kind of switching that mindset from, oh man, this is a failure, to the micro wins, you know, where it's like, okay, on the scoreboard we failed, but I'm going to grow more from this than I would have if it would have been a cakewalk for me. You know, there's always something that you can improve on. I feel like you really get the most to improve on out of those failures or said failures.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think this is kind of like a toolbox time. This is ways that you can teach resiliency in your program or in your family. You start with controlled adversity. We put players in challenging situations during practice, simulated high pressure scenarios to build their confidence in overcoming challenges. That is a controlled adversity environment. We celebrate effort, not just results. We praise the process. We praise things like hard work, preparation, grit, rather than focusing solely on wins and losses. As you said, with the micro learning, it's really invisible growth. You're stacking these bricks. Pretty soon, if you stack them right and you have the right mortar holding those bricks together in the middle of those, you will see a wall.
Yeah.
And you keep stacking, and pretty soon you get a big wall, and then pretty soon it becomes a house, and it's this incredible thing in team environments. We try to create a safe environment for failure. Let players know failure is part of learning. When they fail, don't yell. Ask reflective questions like, what did you learn? What can we do differently next time? Set small, very small, achievable goals. Break challenges into manageable pieces and focus on consistent progress. Practice gratitude. Reflecting on what you're thankful for shifts focus from setbacks to opportunities. You can't be thankful and mad at the same time.
No.
It's just not possible. And you have to develop emotional regulation. We try to teach athletes to pause, breathe, reset, instead of reacting impulsively to the tough situations. Yeah. I think immediately umpires.
Yeah.
You know, it's, let's not have a reaction there. Let's breathe, let's reset, and let's seek some perspective here.
Yep, just adjust.
A journal. Resiliency is built by, can be built by the journaling. We encourage players to jot down moments they overcame challenges and what they learned from those experiences. Our program journals after mental performance on a daily basis. You'll see journals in the dugout. You'll see journals on the bus. You know, some of the questions I've got asked about some of this stuff is like, well, how do you get buy-in? And it's like, it's whatever you ask for, yep. Right? Yep. You've got that hour and a half or 2 hours or 3 hours with that team. So what are you going to ask for?
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe you're going to ask the first time and it's not going to be completely perfect. Not everybody's going to remember to bring their journal for practice, you know, but you don't necessarily have to take that person that forgot their journal and have them go, you know, run the fence or whatever. But it's like, hey, what can you learn from this? And it's like, I'm going to make sure I put it in my backpack every morning when I go to class, and I'm going to have it for practice or whatever. And it's like, yeah, there's a brick stacked right there. Yeah. And pretty soon you have the buy-in. And then pretty soon they're journaling, and then they look back on it a month later, and they're like, whoa, I can't believe I was feeling terrible about doing this sad constraint drill. And now... I see success. I see growth. And then really to dive deep into the weeds, it's about neuroplasticity. Yeah. And without getting super deep in the weeds, it's just understanding it's the brain's ability to adapt and rewire itself in response to challenges. When you repeatedly respond to adversity in a positive way, you strengthen pathways that make resilient behavior automatic.
I like that a lot. Well, Coach Cut, do you have any final advice for our listeners on kind of embracing that resiliency in their own lives, whether they're players, coaches, or parents, or pretty much anybody listening?
I think that's a solid question, and I know that I've turned to over a period of time with resiliency and coaching kind of a top 10 processes for building resiliency. And why I've turned to that is because I think it's imperative for teams to build resiliency.
Yeah.
And embracing resiliency is about adopting a mindset and habits that help you navigate challenges and bounce back stronger. So here are 10 ways to approach it. Number one, reframe challenges as opportunities. Shift your mindset to see adversity as a chance to grow and improve. Instead of asking, why is this happening to me? Ask, what can I learn from this? And remember, setbacks are setups for comebacks. Number two, focus on what you can control. We've heard it often. Control your effort, attitude, and response to situations. But it's so true, because resiliency thrives when you stop wasting energy on what's outside your control and double down on your actions and your mindset. Doesn't matter how cold it is out today.
Yep.
You're not going to die. You're just uncomfortable, yeah, right? Yeah. Have you heard that before?
Oh, yeah. Especially in the UP.
Number three, build a strong foundation. Daily habits. Stack your bricks by building small, consistent habits that improve your mental and physical strength. These practices create resilience over time. A reliable routine helps you stay grounded when life gets chaotic. Remember your why. Accept failure and learn from it. Understand that failure is part of the process. It doesn't define you, it refines you. Use failure as feedback. Analyze what went wrong and how to improve, i.e. journaling is a great way for that. Number five, lean on your support system. We talked about this already. Surround yourself with people who uplift you and challenge you to grow. Sharing struggles and receiving encouragement helps build mental fortitude. Stay present and focused is number six. This is a huge one. because we have so many distractions. Resiliency grows when you focus on the moment rather than worrying about the future or regretting the past. A great way to do this is use mindfulness techniques like deep breathing, journaling, meditation, yoga, that kind of stuff to stay in the present moment. Number 7, cultivate a growth mindset. Believe that you can develop skills and overcome obstacles through effort and persistence. Remember Carol Dweck's principle. She wrote the Great Mindset book. Failure isn't permanent. It's a step towards growth. Number 8, two words that I use very often. Seek perspective. Step back and look at the bigger picture. A challenging moment doesn't define your entire journey. Remember that tough moments are temporary, but the lessons learned can last a lifetime. Number 9, celebrate small wins. Acknowledge the process and progress that you've made, no matter how small it is. Each win, each plus one, reinforces the belief that you're capable of overcoming obstacles. And finally, number 10, stay true to your values. Let your purpose and your core values guide you when the going gets tough. Resiliency is easier when you know your why, and why your why helps you push through. Embracing resiliency isn't about never failing. It's about always getting back up, stronger, and hopefully more determined. It's the practice of taking life's hits and turning them into fuel for future success. That is my top 10. Thank you, Jeff, for joining me today in the WLNZ studios. Make winning in life your habit, not your goal. Remember, excellence is a daily practice, not just a prize. Build great habits and practices that serve you so that you can serve others. And don't forget to cherish the small moments. They pass by in a blink of an eye. Until next time, thank you to all of our listeners. Be resilient. Ultimately, we're all playing a game we can't win, so why not play it to the utmost? Go all in and go Stars. Coach Cut's Corner is recorded live in the WLNZ studios with Dalian Lowry and Jeremy Robinson providing engineering and production assistance. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please share it and follow us on all forms of social media. Our program has been built and maintained with the help of many great people. If you want to be part of our mission, you can donate using the link in the show notes below. You can learn more at CoachCutter.com and more about our team at LCCStars.com. See you next time.
This is LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
The Cesar Chavez Learning Center's Access Program at Lansing Community College creates a community on campus for underrepresented students, providing them with a support network and multiple layers of academic, social, and professional experiences. Access also incorporates workshops and resources that assist in educational and career advancement. To find out more about Access, visit lcc.edu and search Access Program.
What is dedication?
My biggest fear in the middle of my addiction was that my kids wouldn't have a father. I overdosed on heroin, and I lived. And I started thinking, you know what? This isn't my story. My desire to change had finally outweighed my desire to stay the same. I felt powerless for so much of my life. It's important to me that my kids are empowered and truly believe that if they can think it, they can do it. I definitely had to become a better man to be a better father. For the first time, I finally feel like I'm exactly where I should be, where I want to be.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.